Conduct Authority.
And this is an illustrative proposal to cover the costs of supervising their conduct. The other change we envisage is in the financial market infrastructure space, where up until now we've only had one exchange, the JSE, and they were charged a flat fee. Going forward, because of new entrants and the new approach, we will follow the same approach as having a base plus a variable amount, and here the variable amount is proposed to be in proportion to the number of transactions on the exchange, the number of trades on the exchange.
Chair, I think, like both Unati and Jonathan have said, I mean, that's just our initial estimate of what the budget will be. But the budget depends on what you prioritize. So if you take market conduct on banks, if that is a big problem, they're going to have a regulatory strategy to say it's such a big problem, we need 50 others to be working in this area. Okay, that will obviously have an impact on their budget. Okay. Similarly, there are other areas that they may identify that you need to come in. Now, in doing so, I think the important thing to focus on is what is the process every year. So the process, and we're saying considerations for regulator funding process. Firstly, we want to make sure that it's as transparent as the budget process. So in a sense, the regulators will, and say we've been looking at, for example, with the Financial Conduct Authority, there's quite nice documents that they produce. Every year, what, October or so, they publish something for comment. You see the regulatory strategy, you see the areas of priority, etc. So we want to make sure that we have quite a transparent process on the intended fees. I think up to now it's been largely a discussion between the regulators and the regulated institutions. Secondly, we want to make sure that there needs to be some oversight because and the issue then is what's the appropriate oversight because what's the role on one hand they're going to publish their strategy they're going to indicate how they're going to be funded, but what's the role and who checks on the remuneration levels. And bear in mind, in some of these instances, the issue of remuneration will be important because if you take some jurisdictions like, which I know the Hong Kong Authority, for example, they make sure that their highest salary can match that of the top CEOs in the areas that they regulate, the institutions they regulate. I'm not saying we are going anywhere near that. That's a decision that we certainly want to be involved. It shouldn't just be an audit or through their governance process. That's a policy approach that's been taken. So notwithstanding the question of independence, what's the role of the Treasury, of the Minister, and putting such things out in the public domain? How does that come? I think it's also important that we differentiate between the costs related to holding a license, where there's an annual fee and lesser fees. What do you mean by that? Okay. And also the like banks and insurance and many financial institutions, others as well, have to have certain reserve requirements. We need to just differentiate between those. And then when it comes to others, because what we've given here is the costs related to the two core regulators. When it comes to your other activities, like the need to step up consumer education, which we regard as a huge priority, financial education, the ombuds councils, the tribunals, whether that's included in a license or levy is something that we need to also look at. So even when we do the legislation, I think there is an issue of what goes where. The license can take most of the cost of operating the two regulators, but once you get to all the extras, It may be more suited to a levy, again on the financial sector. So if you look at the entire approach, largely it's the regulated institutions which are funding the entire system that's been built around them. Okay, it's not ordinary taxpayers who are expected to pay. Yes, we can talk about the incidents, whether it's customers, but we would contend that when you see that most of the funding comes from the major institutions, these are SIFIs, they bring the big costs, they need to pay the most, okay. And frankly, whether the incidence is on customers or on the salaries of management, because these are not big amounts when you compare to the others. For the major institutions, we can have a debate about where the incidence is. That's aside from Roy's what if a disaster happens kind of scenario. There is a redrafted chapter 16, but you want to just talk about that since some of it was just in time production.
Chair, so yes, we are discussing chapter 16. We've prepared wording, and the idea is that we would probably bring it back when we come back with the bill in October, early October. There are some issues which we need to clarify, and we'll do those with Advocate Jenkins in terms of exactly how the fee setting process must be included. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's just an example.
7 minutes past one. What I'm suggesting is a break for lunch at 2 o'clock. We take the debate.
The same as
but if you want to cut into your lunchtime, I'm fine. Right. So then it's 2 o'clock. We're here. Thank you very much.
Is that Makosi Kos has been asked by the Justice Committee to speak to them about the process. They're appointing, I think, human rights commissioners. So she's been asked to just spell out the process which they underwent in respect of appointing the public protector. And so in fairness to her, she's not sunbathing on the beaches of Cape Town. She's doing work. So I said to her, no, it's fine. She must be entitled to, when she comes back, raise her issues, right? In regard to the input you've just made. Okay, over to, before we go on, can I ask, you see, you've been dealing basically with, you know, the costs of implementing this for regulators and the like, right, and the sources of the revenue. And obviously, included in that is what fines and levies and other appropriate revenues you will secure from the financial institutions, industry, right? But there's another cost factor that we're interested in, as I think we repeatedly said. What would it cost them to implement the system? Now, obviously, you're going to say, how can we tell? But they are here, and they might want to say. Obviously, the tendency for them is to exaggerate, probably. I don't know. If I was in Rosemary's shoes, I would exaggerate it. If Rosemary was in my shoes, she'd be cautious. Right. So what I'm saying is the department will tend to, in general, departments tend to, well, many departments would underestimate the cost so as to convince Parliament it's doable. Industry will exaggerate the cost so that it can come down. Parliament's committee chairs in particular will be cautious because they have to be. So nobody's passing integrity on each of us, Rosemary, Momo and me, will do exactly the same thing as the other is doing right now. But the problem we've got ultimately is the cost that might have to be borne by the customer out there. Now obviously, nobody can give an answer to that. But what we are saying is that at least if we get a sense of what it will also cost the industry, then we can have some sense of what burden the financial consumer might have to bear insofar as possible at all. Okay, having said that, before we ask Pinky to say anything, do you want to explain, just respond to that, Momo, and your team? How are we going to, what was it, invite the industry to speak, or they've done some cost assessments and engagement with you, and so industry, what?
Chair, we can talk through, like Roy says, on the socio-economic impact. But let me say...
This is the document, the impact.
Yes. So, but let me say that, you know, for me, Chair, as you know, whenever you're going to have any levy or any levy increase, there's going to be, a debate, a discussion where people will have... diametrically opposed views, perhaps, okay? And like the way we deal with the tax process, that's why we say we want to really radically improve the process for when we do the annual budget, in a sense, of each regulator. So we want them to say, you know, well before the financial year starts, put out a document for consultation. The rates are put down, the industry and others have an opportunity to comment, etc. We need to oversee that the process is fair, and in a way the documents, the final gazette, or the final, when they're doing the comment, it's also just made available to Parliament as well. If there's a big noise, obviously you are free as Parliament to call people up, but at the end of the day, a lot of this can't be determined right up front, because let's take the transitional mechanism. Some things may be phased in. We're not going to start charging industry for something that's not been done. Some things, as we go and as we see problems, will step up, so depending on what we prioritize. So if you look at this one sheet, which kind of, the slide had some of these examples, but it gives you an idea of the schedule of fees and charges. Now, let me take something like pension funds. Pension funds are relatively lightly regulated currently. With Twin Peaks, we want them to be regulated prudentially, and we want them to be regulated for market conduct. Down the line, there may be other issues that come up. So even, I hate to say this, Chair, but we might have a bill on deposit insurance at some point, okay? If you have deposit insurance for banks, that's not included in what UNATI has put forward, okay? Similarly for pensions, if we decide, like in the UK, for their DB funds, there's a pension sort of fund, so... And not only for pensions, you might think of beneficiary funds like Prudentia. The people who lost money lost it, okay? The only money they would get is what would be recovered from the people who stole their money, okay? Do you have an insurance mechanism for such funds? Those become not regulatory issues, but other protective mechanisms that you're going to have to put. So we're not looking at the entire set of costs. And for all of these, assuming you want to put forward that proposal, you need to show what the benefits are and the costs, so that people are able to assess whether you go ahead. So, Chair, yes, you're right. The actual impact on the institutions, I think, is for them to talk about. But I would contend that most major financial institutions know this is the way of the world, know this regulation is going to happen. And I would guess the sooner it happens, they have more certainty.
Okay. Does the industry want to say anything before we throw it open?
Mr. Chair, only to reiterate what Momo said, which is that it's difficult to estimate at this stage what the costs are going to be, given that the FSR bill is basically an enabling framework. It's only once the standards that are provided for, you know, are all published, then a full assessment can really be made. So the industry did make submissions on charges, on the costs for the research that was commissioned by National Treasury for the impact assessment. We don't have those collated figures. Industry submitted directly to Treasury, but we wouldn't like to come with some figures that we can't really verify at the moment. And yes, costs do have to be borne by someone ultimately. In the case of the financial services industry, it does tend to be either the clients or the shareholders. But it's not that the industry says, oh well, the clients must just bear it all. It's a highly competitive industry, and especially with the comparative measures that are being introduced by ASISA with effect from the beginning of October, we do believe that the improved transparency and cost comparison will increase that competitiveness, because it will be much easier for customers to be able to compare product to product. So in order to remain competitive, they can't just load the customer. So then you look to shareholders, but of course, if shareholders are going to be severely compromised, then that falls to the pension funds and by and large that hold many of the shares. So it is a balance, but as long as we understand that the increased supervision to hopefully proactively detect undesirable market conduct and to detect systemic events and do something about it is an improvement, and we would welcome that, and we know it will come with cost. What we would be interested in is what sort of measures of effectiveness of the new structures would be put in place, because there's a cost, we'll have to bear it. If it is effective and if it is achieving the outcomes that it's all set up for, then we agree it would be worthwhile. But are there going to be measures in place to establish what's working and what isn't?
No, Chair. I think I agree with the first input that you made to Momo, but I also want to indicate to Momo that this is an opportunity for government to also, as we realign or bring in the Twin Peaks, that we also use this process to transform our economy and make sure that those who were not able to participate in the financial sector have an opportunity to play a role. I know I have missed a lot of activities on Twin Peaks, and somewhere I may be irrelevant, but Chair, you'll show me and call me to order. Momo, I'm looking at a situation where, I'm happy you spoke about protection of clients in some of these activities around the financial services sector. And I'm looking at a very big program in black communities of funeral undertakers. It's a huge industry. But they can't get into your mainstream activities. They have to come in underwritten. And I'm not sure everything is protected, or if that funeral undertaker goes down, everything goes down, whatever. But they have been knocking at doors to say, if we want to organize ourselves and want to become a participant in the bigger scheme of things, how do we go about without being underwritten and so on and so on? You know the role that SASRIA plays at another level in risking and ensuring houses in black communities and whatever thing. The bigger chunk of developments now are taking place in rural areas, but those properties can be insured. And if a company wants to take that risk with all those elements and requirements that you said, how do we start to play around and make sure that everybody plays a role in that, in the context of economic freedom in our lifetime? It's just a broad thing that I'm just throwing to you. Specific to the presentation that you made, our focus was more on what the prudential issues would be and what the market conduct would be. And I'm saying I may have missed other things. When we went on that excursion, Chair, that's why at some point we even came back to say it may not be twin peaks, it may be three or four or five peaks, precisely because the credit regulator is part of the package, whether integrated or not integrated, depending on how we face it in as South Africa, given our objective reality here, and the ombudsman. Ne? So that you have, we don't deal with the two, go and sleep, come back and say, by the way, NCR, where do we put you? And then come later on, ombudsman, like what was happening now with the discussion that passed before we had the tax ombudsman, that we are now going to establish it after years and years when we were working on our SARS to become one of the internationally acclaimed institutions. So I'm just saying, the presentation doesn't talk to me on going forward. These are other roles, even if they are not going to be taken care of now, but ideally, this NCR, this ombudsman, I may have left something else, so that we know going forward, how do we take the whole process holistically. Thank you.
Chair, I understand that another chapter 16 is going to be drafted, so I don't want to belabor the point. I mean, let's have a look at what the new draft says. But it is a point of concern for me that when you look at the presentation, for example, in factors taken into account when setting fees, it doesn't seem to be a realization that there needs to be some kind of mitigation of costs, mitigation of transitional costs, and particularly mitigation of costs to consumers, because if the cost to consumers are excessive, it could of course conflict with the objects of the bill, which is to promote financial inclusion. Those are the financial costs. The other question is, I mean, has there been consideration to the economic costs of implementing a bill with such serious implications in an economy which is on the brink of recession? That I think is also a factor that has to be or should be taken into account. But nevertheless, I look forward to seeing the new chapter 16.
Responses, please. Can you be a bit brief in your responses, right? Because can I also ask members for guidance? We are on item 2 out of 11, right, of the policy issues. Now, you see, it's understandable because we've been with this bill for so long that we sometimes cover the same ground. But on the other hand, it's useful. And some people have come in at certain times. The principle in our committee is not to chairperson has a bit of latitude, right? Like with Makosi, it's a straightforward matter. She came to me and she said, look, Eunice, I have to go there. I said, no, that's you doing your work. So she'll be allowed to. So what I'm asking is for guidance, because at this stage, it may. I'm going to very well behave. I'm serious because, I want to get out of Cape Town by Friday, and I won't be able to do it because I've got tons of other work to do, allergic to this committee. So what I'm saying is, your replies shouldn't cover too much of the ground you've covered already. Right? But what I'm also alerting members to is rather than postpone things to the next quarter, that we may have to give an extra hour. So now I know those who are taking buses, there's a 6 o'clock bus. Is Zuki here? Can you check what time the bus has gone? So can members try to stay an extra hour if need be? But hopefully we can still finish by 4:45 without rushing this thing at this stage. So can you reply to the questions on financial inclusion, which is a major theme in everything, right? The disadvantage that some of our laws, bills, and then we become laws have for disadvantaged communities. Then Mr. Mania raised the two questions today.
Chair, some of the topics we're coming to, so yeah. I think what Honorable Kekana raised, the issue is
the next, yeah, so
is coming under transformation and inclusion, right? So let us come to those. I think the two questions we want to deal with is we've just tried to give you the costs and the process. So that's the immediate financial costs and what that would mean and the process that we have. And I think we have argued that when it comes to the budget, yes, everything ultimately or could be imposed on customers, but shareholders would also take some of the heat, as Rosemary said. But we are working from a current level, and obviously it may increase down the line, but let's take it when we come to that. I think the socio-economic study that maybe Roy can just talk quickly through that. But even as he starts, it's almost like some of these provisions, not all, certainly market conduct, there's no international standard, we don't have to do it. We can decide customers are not important, so we don't want to do market conduct. But the prudential ones, I don't think that we have much choice if we want our banks, for example, our insurance companies, to continue to have global linkages, which they do need if they want to operate.
Yes, Chair. As Asisa mentioned, we did a survey of the major firms, and the complicated thing is to understand what the indirect costs are. So it's quite easy, as Jonathan highlighted and Unati highlighted, to know exactly what we're going to charge them. But to try and understand what the cost is of having compliance functions, for example. So, sorry, Janine, if you scroll up a little bit. So this is in the report we circulated with the bill. We asked what is the percentage of the income, for example, the first bullet, and the median value of the reported cost was about 0.7%, and this actually varied quite substantially between institutions. So the lowest costs were 0.1% of their income, and the highest was 5.6%, but 10 of the institutions reported costs about 1% of income or less. And there was a lot of variability, so it's quite difficult to work. I think it depends on different institutions. We asked very large ones, very small ones, and so forth. If you just go down, we then, I'm just really repeating what Asisa said, because they also were part of the survey, that it's quite difficult for them to work out exactly what the indirect costs would be at the moment. But we did feel that this was, and as Roma says, I'm not sure, page 16. Yeah, I think so. Oh, that report, Chair. So just, can you just scroll down a little bit to see where we are?
Yeah.
Is it page 15? Okay, sorry. And so, you know, what we're trying to understand is how much is, what are the actual compliance costs at the institution? And they will all tell you that they all have to have internal lawyers and internal auditors and all of those sorts of things to work out, to make sure they comply with the law and to ensure that they ongoingly comply. So we think these are reasonable, they're not extreme, although the interesting thing was the variability between institutions.
Okay.
worried about managing time. This is related to a chapter you're going to read, you and Bing, in version 3, right? Mm. So we don't need to completely exhaust this issue. And I think in fairness, you can't expect members, otherwise we're going to sit here for hours, a department to spell out the full document. Now, ideally, I know, Antonio, you're going to groan, right? But you will have 2 weeks. Antonio, can you go through this document and summarize it in 2 or 3 pages and pick up on some issues? I know it's a lot, but then members themselves are required to do a bit of reading. So if each of us read 1 page a day, it's doable. And I think it's reasonable to say to a member, read 1 page a day. So we've got how many days? Hands up those of us who can't read 1 page a day. Fine. So you know what? Members will do their job. They will read 1 page a day. Antonia, if you can find the time, summarize it in 3 pages and raise some issues and show it to Dumasani. Well, Dumasani is here. Ask Dumasani to help because he's part of this team. Until the Twin Peaks bill is finished shortly, he can't exit. So Dumasani will help in that regard. Good? Right. Summarize the issues, please.
Yeah.
Don't go through it in great. Give us the key point.
Okay, so if we go to, Janine, if you scroll down to table 4, I think this table really summarizes the document in I think, as nicely as possible. Further down, Janine, sorry. Further down. Page 21. No, I need to put, there we go. So, Chede, what we've done is we've put it, we've tried to combine both the direct costs and the indirect costs. So, we've taken the figures that the regulators gave us in terms of the cost of supervision under the current regulatory framework. So, like they said, currently the combined costs of the FSB and the Reserve Bank are just under $1 billion. That's about 0.27% of the gross value added of financial corporations. So although $1 billion sounds like a big number, if you think about the size of the assets of the banking system, it's not really a large number at all. And that is the combined costs of the... If you then add the indirect costs of compliance functions, that is actually reasonably large. So that is sort of the impact on the institution of having to worry about all these different laws. We estimate that to be in the order of about $3.2 billion, which is just under 1% of the gross value added of the institutions. And so the total cost currently of our financial, and this is very important, this is the current cost of the system of financial regulation, is in the order of about $4.1 billion. And if we push that forward into 2016-17, assuming inflation of in the order of about 7%, actually it's now 5.9%, so it's just under the inflation target, then we're looking at total costs in this year of $4.424 billion. Then if we look at all the different options in terms of the different scenarios around cost implications and cost increases as a result of Twin Peaks, so these are all the different scenarios that, you know, we're not really sure, but we've done quite a lot of thinking about the different scenarios that could occur, then we think that Twin Peaks will probably cost in the order of about $4.5 billion to, in the worst case scenario, which is that overall costs increase by 50%, which is a huge increase in costs. Then we're looking at costs rising to $6.2 billion. But most likely costs, in line with what Jonathan and Unati said, costs will probably rise by about 10%. So the total impact is to take costs to about $5 billion from the current $4.4 billion. So that's roughly the best we could do in terms of trying to estimate what the costs of regulation are on the system, trying to extrapolate what the costs at the moment to what they might cost in the future. It's quite easy to say that, you know, $5 billion is a big number, because it is a big number, but, you know, the Treasury's budget, the total country's budget is $1.1 trillion this current financial year. The Treasury alone costs $1.2 billion. You know, it's I think it's quite a manageable number.
I don't think
I won't compare it to what SAA.
I don't think the average.
The other numbers you've heard this week.
Right. Very difficult is the average worker does than $1.3 million, $3 billion, right? All right, so you're done.
Yeah.
Right. Let me just say, this is a two-part process. We're coming back to this the week we get back and we look at you. I think it's week two. Obviously, you've done a lot of work from what I can see, right? And I think you've been good. But the problem we will have as a committee is, how do we know that the figures you've got are credible, right? If you're sitting in my chair, the chair of this committee, my seat, not that you want to sit here, not in this day and age, quite frankly. What will you say? If not, yeah, okay, I see these figures. But how do I know they're credible, firstly, right? I can see you did a lot of work. I actually browsed through this earlier. I forgot you gave us this quite a while back, eh? Yeah, I have looked at parts of it, but I didn't read the whole thing. It's immensely boring, but I did read it one day. Not the whole thing. I looked at it last night. I thought, hey, I have come across this stuff. But it was a different copy because I made notes on it. And I'm not going to look for it in the millions of stuff I got on my table. So look, basically, colleagues, I'm just saying to you, let's get real, right? Firstly, this committee doesn't have the capacity to evaluate how credible what you have done is. And in our report to Parliament, we need to say that. That, hey, we do the best we can under very difficult circumstances. Right? Now, we're going to ask Antonia to do the work. Now, what expertise has Antonia got to assess the credibility of this, to be fair to her? She doesn't have it, right? Why should she? So we look upon industry to respond and say, hey, are these figures credible? They seem to think, well, they've looked at all these things, right? But you see, for us, the final concern is how will this impact on the customer? And nobody can give us an answer to that. We understand, right? But it would be nice if there were some regulatory provisions that restrict the capacity of the financial institutions. What is there to increase the cost for the customer? Is there some regulatory mechanism that exists? I'm trying to guide this meeting because we can have a long discussion, intellectual and all that. At the end of the day, hey, we need to know what are we saying about these figures, what capacity we've got to actually make a sensible statement. I'm telling you, I don't. I'm telling you up front, I don't know. I'm probably read this more than most of the members here. Right, so that's for you to answer right now, Momo. I am asking the comrades and colleagues here to comment within that context. How are we going to judge this? Can somebody guide me? I've never been in a committee where I felt so impotent. I've told you this before. How are we going to know, even if Makosi is here, let's say Makosi is our best person in the ANC, right? And Topham, I think, is the other very good person in this committee, neither of whom is here. How are we going to assess this? What are you expecting from us in terms of oversight? Maybe I ask you that first. What can you say, before the members come in, can you tell us what you expect us to say apart from what the committee chairs just said?
Chair, any socioeconomic study, these types of studies depend on the assumptions.
Yeah.
If two different people did it, I have no doubt you'll get two different estimates, okay? So it's like forecasting.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it completely useless.
No, I agree.
Right, so it gives you a feel, okay? And certainly it gives you something that if in later years we deviate from this, it's clearly something we can come and talk about, why were we wrong? And therefore we perhaps do need to review the approach. Let's say if the costs were 10% of GDP, okay? Which certainly have to come because it may impact on the cost of capital for development and so on, okay? So, you know, these things, you put it out, let other people comment. But let me say, and this is what I've said before, whatever the costs, a lot of the architecture for this legislation came from the Red Book. And it's in the context of the 2008 crisis. The world has moved. So if we showed you, for example, the costs in the UK, from what they paid to regulate in 2008 to what they pay today, you'll see how their costs have really increased. There's also other costs, Chair, that we're not looking at here, like we did the FIC amendment bill. So if you look at that bill, the cost of dealing with money laundering is probably, I think, may even be one of the biggest expenses for banks, more than some of these as well. Okay, I'm not talking about the reserve requirements. So that's that. In terms of your other question, Chair, what it means for the customer and cost, this is precisely why it's so revolutionary, because we're setting up a market conduct regulator. Their job is to see that customers are treated fairly. Their job is to see that products are more appropriate, they're comparable, and so on. If you look at the work that we've done, for example, on retirement reform, where we looked at the costs on your retirement policies, you know, it could be 40-50% depending on what type you could have in a particular scenario. The thing is that has led the industry now to have a much more transparent sort of measure of this, but the pressure must still be there to bring down costs and for the customers. So, the biggest rationale for me in this bill is one, to get financial stability, because the prudential stuff has been happening, but to get financial stability at a macro level. But perhaps even more important, to make sure that customers are treated fairly. And by fairly, we are dealing to a large extent also with the issues of access. I mean, let me give you an example. Only 1 in 3 people have motor car insurance. 2 in 3 cars are not insured. Industry comes and says, can't you make this compulsory? We've said, before we even think of making compulsory, because that's a good idea, can you think about lowering your costs and asking why 2/3 can't afford the products that you provide? Okay. So this allows, this is a big revolutionary and transformational thing, because this will affect millions of people in hopefully, if we do succeed in a market conduct objectives, and we get better products to access and so on.
To what you're saying. I just wanted some parameters within which we have this discussion. And what I'm saying is there, for example, it might help to ask, let's take the advanced economies, right? Like in Britain, do you know what their modeling exercise suggested the cost would be as against what the cost has turned out to be? Is there a significant discrepancy? One, right? Two, do you know what the average increase in the administration and other fees you pay to the bank has been since the model was introduced, right? Thirdly, is there any way in the world where there's a regulator? I know you'll say the market forces will flee, you know, the banks will disappear. Well, if that's the case, we'll have to live with it for now. But is there some way, you know, without unduly interfering in the market, that the state can restrict the increases in annually in fees by banks and insurance agencies? Is there any example of that in the established world? I'm not talking of North Korea and all that, right? I'm talking about the real world, okay? I mean, until we have a Marxist state, those issues don't arise. We're living in a mixed economy, and we have to be realistic. Even somebody like me would say that. So go for it, Momo.
You know, there may be countries that try and do that, aside from North Korea. But once you start capping costs, you may get other perverse outcomes.
So there's no way in the world?
No, I'm not saying that. I said there may well be, but certainly most of the countries that we would compare to, I don't think...
What about the progressive
social democracy?
And I just want to make this point.
Yeah.
The thing in America was, your bank charges were zero. We actually don't want zero bank charges. Because when you had bank charges being zero, that's where the banks were forced to gamble, okay, and did these teaser loans, okay, and build up this bubble. So you would get a housing loan today, house prices rise in 2 years' time, your house is now worth 120%, you refinance, you now get another 20% more than you did before, and that's how you continued, and that's where the thing exploded. On the other hand, the other extreme is where you do have concentration and high charges, okay, the banks are completely safe, okay, because, you know, they're making such super profits that they'll be safe. So where the bank sits...
You're really making the case for socialism.
So I'm saying we need something in between, and that's where we need two regulators, and there's a healthy tension, and each one with a dedicated objective, one betting for the customers, one betting for safety of the institutions, because that's a country objective, and you hope between the two you won't get the extremes that you want.
See, you're talking about protecting the customer through conduct authority. We're talking about financial costs of services, right? Cost of services. Conduct authority can't say, it can ensure a better deal in the way the banks operate in respect of the relation. It doesn't, there's no say on the bank charges. But leave that aside, I think I've taken this thing as far as I can. I've suggested, in short, it's a two-phase process. Two, that let's be careful about how much we can effectively exchange with this, or engage with this. Right. Having said that, hand over to some of you. Yes, Dumasani, thank you.
Afternoon, Chair, with members and colleagues. Just want to touch on that, Chair, because when we had a discussion with colleagues from the UK, I think the protection of consumers was one of the very important aspects. We talked to the cost as well. I was talking to Antonio here, you know, to talk about the role of the ombudsman there, because I think that quite came very strongly. They've got a very strong consumer protections body in the UK, which you know, is able to come in where consumers feel that they have been unfairly treated by the financial institutions, or either way or other way around. But I think because it's in different folds, because you've got the cost to the economy itself, which one of the bigger challenge which the UK economy faced was the fact that the regulations would somehow be seen to affect the economy's growth, or was somehow make it difficult for the institutions themselves to continue being creative and actually function as institutions. That's the first element of costs, which I think it's also very important to look at. But I think exclusion is a bigger issue, and the cost to the consumers. But I wanted to throw this back to the colleagues to say, how much is the ombudsman's role going to come out quite strongly here? Because I think it's quite difficult to say, you know, whether you can cap the cost or not. But I think the role of the ombudsman and other you know, non-financial institution bodies on the side of the consumers will come very important. Thanks.
My question about whether it would be wise to implement or begin to implement this bill in an economy on the brink of recession, when the effect of the bill will be practically an additional tax on business, whether any consideration was given to that.
Mr. Mayor, if we took that approach, because remember we're already imposing a tax, then perhaps we should say, do we want to impose corporate taxes because there's a recession? Okay, I mean, I'm saying I think the issue is in this more the way you start increasing the fees, and that's why I say that the crucial thing will be the annual rounds that you have. And let me say, the first three annual rounds, once they are probably going to be critical, because it will be getting back to the right pace. Hopefully the economy will be growing then as well, much faster. So, you know, I think we'd be mindful. I mean, so what I'm saying is, in these things, it's when you actually do it that you need the consultation, and the process is important. And that will determine the speed with which you do certain things or don't do certain things. But the basic regulation has to go on, and it's being done currently. But it's setting up of the new market conduct regulator and how fast it expands and so on that one needs to look at. Look, if you look just the last week, Wells Fargo got a huge fine. Okay, the European economies are not in a great state. Maybe that's why, you know, Apple and them are getting their fines. Now, those are tax issues, but you're seeing corporates really face a lot of pressure from different types of regulators in the current thing. And, Chair, that doesn't fund the regulators, because if it's a fine, in our system, the money should go to the fiscus, because you don't want to have perverse outcomes. Otherwise, the regulators will fine everybody to increase their budget.
You can't shape legislation on the basis of the growth rates at a particular time. I mean, what that suggests, if there's any validity in what Mr. Mania is saying, is it affects your transitional provisions, your phasing in. When you phase in aspects of the model, you will take into account that you don't want to disincentivize business in a way that affects economic growth rates. And I think you manage that reasonably well, is my take. So I trust you more in that regard. And I think it reemphasizes the need for transitional provision. But see, Mr. Meni has to raise that, and it's fine. That's what his party stands for. So even if he didn't raise it, I would have known that that's preoccupying the DA.
Unapologetically stand for economic growth.
It's not about that. It's about who shares the blame for the revenue and how much. That's what we're talking about. And basically, nobody is against economic growth. I think the EFF were the most populist member of parliament wants economic growth. What they want to do with that growth is what we'll defer on. So having said that, I think members, can we leave it for now unless, Viso, you've got any issues? All right, so what we're going to do is, Teboho, every morning, members of the entire committee, I hope they're listening. I hope Mr. Lees is listening and they'll convey to Mr. Topham. We're all paid by the fiscus. So every morning, can you please send to Teboho a report on you having read one page of this thing. Phule Mabe is not here, the whip. I will speak to him when he's back in circulation. ANC comrades, every day to Zukiswa. So those who are not here, just remind me at the end of the meeting. So there'll be no excuse. How many pages is this? It's how many pages? Oh no, it'll be 1.5 pages, comrades. I know it's very stressful, but but on a more serious note, what we're asking for is for members to browse through this. Antonia and Dubasani, if they can get their act together by the 11th of October, if you could do a 2-3-page summary and raise some issues for us. And can we move on to the next issue? I think the other issues, some of them will go quite quickly, others will. Now, the next issue is around the costs, we've got that, around constitutionality issues. I think this is a straightforward one, eh? For the most part, from what I can tell, almost all, if not all, the constitutionality issues are now settled, right? The people who raise themselves say, okay, we settle with the changes you've made as Treasury. Is there any constitutionality issue left?
Chair, I would suggest you ask Aziza. I don't think we have none, but I think they have any left.
No constitutional issues left, thank you.
We don't want to raise any constitutional issues at this stage, but it is possible that we will at a later stage. That's dependent on taking legal advice. Chair, there are no constitutional issues which we intend to raise now, but I can't rule out that we might raise constitutional issues, but that would depend on legal advice.
Okay. It's your right to do whatever you want to do, but it would seem to me reasonable that any party which is arriving at a view that there's some or other aspect of the bill that's unconstitutional, maybe they want to raise it in the committee first and say, and maybe there may be a case that the lawyers on Parliament side, Advocate Jenkins, the lawyers on the National Treasury side, whoever they are, as many as they are, will advise so that we can, if there is a constitutionally sound argument, Parliament's obliged to pass legislation that is constitutionally sound. But we know that people go to the Constitutional Court also for political reasons, right? And we can't do anything about that. What can you do? They want to win votes and all that and seem like they're very radical. And so what can you do about it? Nothing. Fine. So the next issue then is the UK study tour lessons. Did you make copies of that, right? All right, we can do that. Okay.
So, Chair, we were asked I think he's not here. But the whole issue of transformation in the financial sector, I think, let me just outline the transformation that we've been involved in the financial sector. Move on. Chair, I think when we look at transformation, there's obviously many elements to it. It could be ownership, it could be management, the composition, it could be access, it could be affordability, inclusion, competition. It's not an exhaustive list, okay? And certainly I think the financial sector as a whole is a key enabler to sustainable economic empowerment and development. I think from what we've, the sense that we've just had is certainly financial inclusion is a very important objective. Now this is over and above market conduct, treating customers fairly. It's to really get more participation by ordinary persons, certainly previously disadvantaged individuals, black-owned businesses, you've come the right time, black-owned businesses, how do they actually get into the financial economy? Okay, let's not deal with the broad thing for the moment. But we've had cases, for example, if you take panel beaters, what they would find is many insurance companies would only go to two companies to go in tow, or they would say that you have to go to selected providers. In fact, the previous chair, I think, was also of this committee, was also involved in that area of business in his previous life. Okay. No, not him. He's a communist. Okay. But the previous chair was also a communist, but he was involved in business. Okay. But so there was a whole issue there, and I think a really legitimate issue.
We took a decision quickly, the chairperson is going to be here, and I've been very good except for 1, 3 months.
That will be the one. So, Chair, this has been a big... I'll just give you an example of the type of issues we take up. I'm not going to go into Zanzi bank accounts and so on to make sure everyone has a bank account. We can come to that. But I also think that the whole issue of consumer education is also important, and Lindahl is here from the FSB. Maybe he can talk about it. He's responsible for consumer education. He can talk about this if you want any more input. I think the other transformation that we've been involved in a big way is one of the first empowerment charters was actually the financial sector charter, which was done back in 2003. Now, before I get there, with regard to the market structure, there's a lot of transformation one can undertake. Do you guys want to add on to the market structure point? Which is the last bullet there. I'll deal with the financial charge.
Sure. So this is an issue really about how do we change, and this is a much more complicated issue on how you change the market structure itself and what actually does that mean. And there's different ways of going about it. One can try and dismantle what's there, or you can set up new agencies, which could be government-led or other, or try and provide an enabling environment. So where there's barriers to those new entrants coming in, try and provide an environment which caters and accommodates those players. And that's very importantly what the role of the Competition Act tries to deal with. This question of contestability is one where it's not just about... you might only have a few number of players, but contestability means that new players can enter, and that's the market outcome, is that on how many players you've got. The entry barriers, as they're relevant to to our context is particularly around the regulatory barriers, which have been spoken about considerably. And we will get to how we see that those need to be and can be much better accommodated in the new framework than the existing framework, the legal framework, I mean.
So those issues obviously are a very important area, because the lower the barriers, the more entry you have, possibly more competition. But it now needs to be balanced with you have licensing requirements. How do they impact? You know, they need to take that into account. They shouldn't be so high that nobody enters. But at the other extreme, the more you know, if you lower your license barriers, you're going to have the kinds of activity which we almost get forced to regulate against. Move on. So, Chair, just with regard to the financial sector code, the actual financial sector code precedes the BBB EE Act, Broad-Based Economic Empowerment Act, which was done in 2003, and in fact only started taking effect, if I remember, around 2008 or so, when they published the Gazette. The financial sector charter transformation objectives started around 2000-2001. There was a long process, and let me say these processes are always difficult, because on the one hand there's a property rights issue, people who own those rights who obviously don't want to give up their rights, but there was the kind of entire industry. You had the Red October campaign, the financial transformation conference, what was it, I'm forgetting the term, which came into being. Then what happened was that as the codes came themselves, codes of good practice took effect, we then needed to change the original charter to fit in. And then there were further amendments. So currently, for example, we've just got the application from the Charter Council to gazette the latest in terms of the new laws that you have. And Chair, if you look at that charter, the kind of big issue there was because ownership was direct ownership, for example, in the banking sector, was lower than, say, the 25% that most charters had. You had a 10-15% direct-indirect ownership. And the rationale for this was that, for example, in a bank, once you have more than 15%, especially at that time, you would be a shareholder of last resort. No, what do you call it again? Shareholder of reference, sorry, not last resort. Okay, yeah. Shareholder of reference, which would mean that he'll explain it just now, okay, but where the bank needed capital, you would be called on. So, when we wanted to empower, we didn't want to put this burden onto new emerging owners in a bank. Obviously, and this is the point of the bank. You've got to be not just very rich. You can't borrow from another bank to own another bank, or one bank to own another bank. You've got to actually have hard capital. You've got to be rich, whether you're black or white. And of course, many corporates or funds have that kind of fund. So a lot of the focus was on access to financial services. Certainly around the 2000s, that was a big issue. And then, of course, there were issues like empowerment financing. There were issues like, Honorable Pinky, you kind of talked about issues like effectively redlining. Around 94, many township houses couldn't get a bond. So the way companies were risk rated, a lot of those sorts of problems were taken up. When you said some people can't get insured, that worried me. That's a form of redlining, which we should definitely take up to the extent that it exists. Move on. So this was quite a process, and Chair, in fact, it would be great if one day you could, they used to come every year, the financial sector charter to come and report annually. And it would be great, I think, one day just to have them. And you'll see, and you would see actually why each of these would be carefully negotiated. There would be very different positions, but they've actually managed to come together, I think, after a lot of turbulence between 2008 and 2012, 2013, but they've come together. So certainly this act for us, if you're looking at the ownership issues, the management issues, I think really does lay the basis for that aspect of transformation. I think, Chair, you know, I don't want to go into all, we've just laid out some of the issues. All the issues that you have, once empowered, always empowered, come up, that you read about in newspapers, those are all long discussions that we could have. But I would contend it's been reasonably successful. But I do think that in the time when you had this fight over the ownership issue, that we actually lost a lot of time on transformation. And what happened was that a lot of the excess targets, I think the question was, are they tight enough? Because people were scoring, institutions were scoring well, but sometimes, you know, if the level is very low, you're going to score well. The issue is you need to tighten those targets and so on. Okay, move on. Yes, yes. I'm very familiar. So I think that if you look at in the bill, certainly if you look at transformation from this perspective, that it pretty strongly supports financial inclusion, but we were asked to focus more on transformation, specific, I think, to, I think members meant the ownership and participation issues. Of previously disadvantaged individuals. We do have other institutions which emerge from there, like the Corporate Banks Development Agency. A lot of those came out of those issues of micro-insurance, which we could go on, because I think Kathy, in fact, led a paper on micro-insurance, the funeral.
We'll also talk about it on the insurance bill.
Yeah, okay. And when if we do the insurance bill today, we can talk through that. Move on. So I think just these are some of the other areas and legislation that you have to deal with it. But I think the important point is you see the word coffee there, okay. That's the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill. That bill, remember, is going to give effect to the draft market conduct framework. The standards that we've been talking about, that is the bill that will give effect to this. And, you know, I'm hoping that later this year, at least we could publish a draft and come back in Parliament, because it really goes very closely with this. But to take account of members' suggestions, we thought this is how we would put it. Have you got the draft clause? Okay. Do you want to add? Okay.
We look at the clause. I think one of the issues that's been raised, besides the regulatory barriers to entry, one of the issues, I think the challenges from the regulator side, is it's one thing to create an enabling law, it's another thing to support the formalization of businesses to comply with that law. And the CBDA was set up to do that for banks, I think that is progressing, although I think we need to do that role better. The question, though, is can we expand that role for other institutions as well, other entities? So one of the issues one of the sectors that's been raised is on the funeral parlours, for example. How can we help? What can we do to support possible new entrants in getting their governance right, in understanding what the law means, and making sure that we are not crowding out existing participation? And already the FSB could have taken a much stronger stance on the funeral parlours if it was a strict application of the law, which they have not done. And the reason why they have not done that is in the expectation of the increasingly enabling insurance framework, which is through the insurance bill, which is coming, but also through trying to provide this formalisation support as well.
ago, the issue was
we
would have legislation we said would bring for dedicated banks, and we then put the Cooperative Banks Act in. And I think just from Kathy's point, obviously having the legislation there doesn't lead to development in these areas. And I think the whole area of competition really does come in, and not just in banking, I would say with insurance, and this was in the FSEP study, for example. Right?
Yeah. Sorry, Chair, for a banking nerd like me, the one of the most interesting museums is this museum in Scotland, in Edinburgh, where they show how banks developed over time. And, you know, we had building societies back in the day, and I was at the Edinburgh Festival, if that helped.
My first task was financed by the United Building Society.
Yes, who are now part of APSA, I think. And that's kind of how banks develop over time. I think Janina's struck me up. But the idea is that we introduce a system that banks can grow up through, from cooperative banks through to mutual banks, all the way through to big banks. And it hasn't been, you know, I think as Mama said, you know, we have created the framework for it, but it is a very difficult thing to build a bank, even to build it from scratch. And, you know, there are three mutual banks, Finbond, Grahamstown Building Society is a mutual bank, GBS, Vendor Building Society, which has been in the news recently.
And then what would the post office be?
The post office is currently, so when we put under there, new licenses. The post office is now in on a pathway to getting a full banking license, and that requires them to upgrade their systems. And there's quite a lot of work they have to do, but they are on a path to getting a new license. And there are a number of other applications. I'm not sure where they all are in the process. There are always new banking applications, but there is this idea that you can kind of create a pathway into banking.
Is meant to regulate for the two or three objectives. So in the objects, we have put transformation, but that we expect that to be done, obviously, through the BEE legislation. And therefore, in the definition, we define, because we think members meant transformation in terms of BEE and so on.
Yeah.
So we've defined it in that way. We've put in a clause, transformation of the financial sector in the object. Just show the definition before you come to clause two.
As you recall, we instructed them.
Yes.
And I'm glad you've gone. I think it'll come in version three of the actual amendment. It's very good to
start. Okay. And then we have a definition. We have a definition that by transformation we mean transformation in terms of the BEE Act, something like that. Janine will get the words up. But we were worried that just on two, just put your point two.
Well,
that
you did not give us that document,
the transformation. No, it's done today. We'll make copies. Yeah. So I think we were just worried that the particular objectives and functions of the regulators, because we are creating these as narrow, dedicated, they must just do their focused jobs, that doesn't in any way, there's no confusion around that. The opening says some. Okay. It's okay.
Can I just add in on, in terms of this hierarchy, and it's something which we've been having a lot of discussion. We've got an object of the Act, and then you've got the objectives of the authority, and then there's functions of the authority. And there was a TriStar case, and the lawyers can come in here, where where what was highlighted in that case is that it's important to say, if you've got multiple objectives, you need to try in your legislation to say which are the most important objectives and how should an authority in this instance give effect to its mandate according to this basket of objectives, as it were. And that's why that's the basis for two as well.
On us. You're doing.
Okay, you give us a sense of what the definition is. We can actually look at it. Now, you have gone, I must say, further than I thought you would. I thought you would resist some of this, right? So I think you have done quite a bit. I think, you know, we give us a chance to look at the actual wording. It's that sub 2 looks slightly odd, but leave that aside for now. Over to colleagues.
Let me apologize up front if Pinky and the rest have covered me on an important point, which is transformation of the economic sector. You know, if I had a full day, I will go to town on what I would have wanted to say, you see. First, the patterns of ownership and control needs to change in South Africa. And it's going to be a radical change. It's not going to come on a silver platter chair, and I'm warning you, it's going to come. When it knocks on your door, listen to what I've got to say. You see, when we're dealing with the BEE codes, I don't know, are we still here? Are we still here? Are we still here? No, it's very important because I will not understand the current situation, because a commission had to be put in place to address this matter. There's currently a commission in the GTI. Because there was an outcry that the manner in which we take issues of transformation, you know, it's like we're producing people to pick up plastic bags in the streets, and then we say we've created economic transformation. You see, here we're talking about stock fails and so on. There are people who are interested to be in the banking sector, Pinky, and they don't want to be on your lower rank of corporate financial institutions or either mutual banks. They want to be your first tier that you have presented there, right? And these are the people that we know, for any other reason, that the current laws are very stringent in taking them into consideration, right? Just for a level of cooperatives, you need almost 200 people to bring about few millions of rents. Right. I'm reducing it to few, because few can mean one in English terms. And if there is no radical approach to change the fundamental policies that lock them out, it's not going to happen. We're not going to realize it. The state intervention, and now I'm raising the party political position about establishing a bank. I'm not going to be apologetic about it, right? There was a resolution that the issue of the post-bank alone is not sufficient enough for financial inclusion. Now, I'm not going to talk about licensing fees. They are very low to me. Anybody can. They can bring 500 people. They can afford that. The issue, the gist there is the ability to reserve, right? It's not the licensing. They can afford that. But the principle of how much you should be able to have to qualify, the adequacy thereof, it's limited here by this fundamental requirement to be able to have a particular amount of money to qualify. I mean, really, if Patrice is not interested, the deputy president is not interested, Tokyo is not interested, it means for now, and in the coming 20 years, there's no black people who will be able to be in that sector. And SAB will have to give guidance on this one. We will have to change the way we do things for it to happen. At least for now, the Communist Party has abandoned the agenda. I'm sorry to say it here. I do not want to say it. No, we have abandoned the agenda, Mankabani. I don't want to talk about
it.
I was raised by communists. No? So I don't know what. You can call me anything, but I was raised by communists. I was raised by communists. You can call me anything. You see, it's not issue of good governance. Good governance, that one we'll fight for with our head. We'll make sure that people doesn't do crime, doesn't do money laundering, but it cannot be correct in a country where the majority of people are left out in the economic activities and only the minority are the ones. It can't be correct, and we should not shy away from talking about it. And it means if we say on their own, they must find way. The fact that even today we're still talking about fees, education is still not accessible to the majority. It means in the coming 50 years, they will not be able to break it. Now, we don't want to do what Zimbabwe has done. Give people who can farm farms and then they don't know what to do with them, then they come back to the state or they are redundant. That's not what we're saying. We're not anywhere near that. We're basically saying we should empower people. If you wanted to run a bank, you should be competent enough to be able to do that. But you should be able to mobilize resources for you, not on a free platter, but to take you through over time. So for now, the question can be, how many corporate banks we have? In the past, for me to qualify for a loan, I went to the Free State Development Corporation, a bond, I mean rate. Even today, if you want a lousy 3 million at my post, you can't get it at APSA or any other bank. They give you all sorts of stories why they cannot give you. You run around here as a black South African. Not even your position as a member of parliament can secure you a loan. Now we can imagine ordinary people in the seats. So the BEE charter is under commission, and I wanted the officials from the DTI. I don't see them. This is a very crucial part of the debate that we should have them to give us an idea what is in front of that commission that is led by the wrongdoers. To see how, moving forward, are we going to include some of the principles of inclusion in this aspect. Phasing it in over time. And that's where the issue of time frames come in, Chair, even if we don't like them. Because we can safely say in 20 years we should be having 3-4 black-owned banks or entirely owned by South Africans themselves, not having their bases somewhere else and so on and so on. And technically we claim that they're South African when we know it's something else. It's a combination of factors. And here, I wouldn't mind if that is it. It's a combination of the racial groups of what comprises South Africa as a society. But it's something that we can say, during our lifetime, we fought for, it is there, we were able to do it, and not just do business as usual, the way things are, and say, no, the law, you know, the prescripts of the law are not written, are not inscribed with gold on a slate that can never be broken. It can't be. It's not possible. It's not like that. We just fashioned, you know, I remember when I became a VIP, they opened the door. I said, no, wait, this thing make you change behavior. You know, I said that not to, you know, you start even to work differently, you know. Yeah, you feel it.
Speak for yourself.
No, I'm telling you, Chair, there are many people who are doing that. I said, no, it cannot happen. I'll open my door. I'll close it. I used to jump before the car stops. I showed them that I came from the UCC, so I used to jump. By the time they come, I'm already out. Because it makes you to start to be diluted.
I've never had that opportunity.
You are not an MEC.
No, this one kill pansola kostrating on me. Now, you see, Chair, these are the issues that if we don't address them, they will be coming in an unprecedented manner.
Not because unprecedented, but in an unexpected time. And neither the industry nor the government.
And because I was there, the DTI took the knock as if the problem is with the DTI. When the problem is not with the DTI, it's not. You see, the problem is not with the DTI. The problems are somewhere else. The DTI did not even have capital injection enough to be able to help those who wanted to pursue certain businesses. We cannot forever put our people at the lowest rank in society. But own the petrol stations, few of them there and there, and you say we have arrived. We have not arrived. And I do not envisage a situation where first the system must collapse for it to correct, to self-correct. We should be privy of these issues because they are there. And this government, this noble government led by a noble organization, has always taken different views into one melting pot. We don't go to the extremes. The NC-led government does not go to the extreme. It doesn't say nationalize, doesn't say privatize, it says let's have something in between and make it work. Let Pinky's having a piece of cake here, let that cake be shared amongst all of us, equally. You see, nobody will complain. Now she's having it alone there, all by herself. You see, and that's the problem.
Very profound point, yeah.
You know, this young guy from the Youth League put it in a very rude way, say, we'll open the fridges and eat all the cheeses. He was trying to tell you that revolution is coming. Mm-hmm. It might have sounded so literal, but he was saying that the poor will not ask permission for you to come and take from you if you don't share with them. They're not going to ask for permission. They will come. And when they come, they'll take everything. You'll read the statute books and say all these things, but it will have happened. So we don't want us to arrive at that situation. I don't want to preach. So I want us to have something. It might not be now. We must signal something. SAB must tell us what are they doing towards achieving this goal. We want to see in the next 30 years, even if it's one black-owned bank, can't be criminal for black people to own a bank. If it's okay for white people to own a bank, it must not be criminal for black people to own a bank. They should be helped in the know-how, how to do that, because I always say when we talk about tax matters, we take it for granted that everybody understands the prescripts of the law. It's not like this. Even those who start businesses, they are caught up for not paying taxes, and because they don't even understand how it works. They venture in because they've got access to resources and so on, and they start taking chances. Even those who build roads, they end up building wrong roads because they've never been taken step by step to arrive at a situation where they are professional, they can do it, and they do it in the best of their abilities. So basically, that's the point I wanted to advance, that we should start to signal that we are moving towards that direction. It's a resolution of conference, we must pursue it, that I don't know by when, I can't say by when, but there should be that bank starting to reserve funds for that. It means even in National Treasury, it's got a big task towards that.
Momo is listening very attentive.
Let me leave it at that, Chair.
Yes, Momo, it's a signal to industry as well.
Yes.
If they do not play...
They must partner.
...on transforming. Nobody is going to negotiate with them tomorrow. Today, there's still the space.
Yes.
I don't think, you know, MPs like us are going to be here in the next era. Who are negotiating with you... You're having a say here till the last moment you vote on the bill. It's not going to happen like that. In fact, Parliament will be overridden. So what we are saying is, look, I think the point Tandi has made, has been a lot of it has been covered before, but she's put it in a much more coherent way, and she's encapsulated. I hope the officials, I suspect, Momo, you are a bit more alive to what's possible, and so with due respect to your fellow officials here, you can sense by the, let's say, idiom that people use, by the chemistry with which they engage with this committee. I've seen one or two of them in different forums. They need to adjust to the reality of what the way this country is right now. So I don't think we can go further than where Tandi is saying. Personally, I agree with almost everything Tandi says. Where she and I might disagree would be, you know, in the ANC as well, there's no clarity on these issues, so we can... Where we might disagree is on how much of that is catered for in this bill and how much of that goes in the report and how much of that is covered in your future bill. And the more I think about it, Antonia, when you do your draft, a key theme must be around a high level of, the next point is related to monopolization of the banking sector. If I'm correct, the four major banks are having almost 90% of the market. And I raised this with you privately, Momo, and I think we need a discussion, as we said. So I think one of the things we're going to do is, we recognize we can't do everything that Tandi says in this. We recognize we also need a mandate from our own party political structures on how far you go. It doesn't just involve finance. It also involves DTI, economic development, other committees. But we can also look at how the other bills that are coming. We must, you see, we understand, you explained to us, I think we largely agree with them. So we're not saying that everything Tandi's saying goes into this bill. It can't. Some issues are around policy, some are around strategy, some are around regulations. They don't go into a bill. But I think our report, Antonia, must make this a major theme. What is it here? F. Financial inclusion, transformation, monopolization. What you could start doing is look at the South African banks, the high level of monopoly. Look at the financial sector charter, where it's gone. The Communist Party, for what it's worth, feels not enough progress is achieved. And I think, Momo, you're right. We must bring the financial sector charter committee here to explain where progress is. But I'm pleading with your colleagues more than you, Momo. You understand how much of it you agree with is different. I'm not sure that they do, with the greatest of respect to them. And you know, it comes back to this point also. I know it's difficult, Momo. I don't envy you. I know the challenges. When I speak to my former university colleagues, we have similar issues. But your teams are not representative enough, you know, 23 years later. We're not casting an integrity on anybody here, Momo. They're all hardworking people. They all mean well. They're all serving the public out there. They're not narrowly serving any party. And they mean well. I've interacted with some of them. We were with Roy and Kershia. Ask Pinky and Tandi. I mean, you know, we'll do how many days? 5, 6 days, I can't remember. We don't tell, we like them, they're nice people, and we're not questioning them personally. Yeah. But Momo, I know what you're going to say, I don't think we need to discuss it here. I don't think our committee can escape the responsibility to push the executive. Momo, you're such an astute political activist up to 94, right? I keep telling you, I have enormous respect for you, really. I really think you do excellent work. I don't agree with your race, but hey, you're a gem in that department of yours. And I think it's partly your influence on your team here. You know, you make them work really hard, and I think probably the majority in the ANC agrees with me. But I know you from a long time, and I know how politically astute you used to be. And you can't just be a bureaucrat, particularly in the current time, given the challenges you in finance have. How much of it is really related to finance issues and broad, how much the broader political terrain. Not that we're taking sides on the matter, I'm just saying. It's become highly politicized. And you can see, Momo, it's treasury, all of you need to understand this. I'm sorry that we're getting so heavily political, but you are under pressures of variety of sorts, not just your minister over what's going on in the Hawks matter. Every now and then you see powerful, I'm not talking about the strata of an elite that's emerging that's only about itself. Self, self, self. So if you gave them something, they'll shut their mouths. Right? I'm not talking about that. There's a legitimate strata that has no like self-interest per se. That's saying we have to de-racialize the economy as a whole. And one of the areas that is very, very racialized is the financial sector. That is why when we came to the Reserve Bank, I did say to many people, I was so impressed, right? We came when Jill was still there. And Jill is a comrade, right? Which is history. She has to apologize initially. She was prepared to sacrifice her life. So I don't care about the fact that she's white, you know? But I always thought that Saab had a layer before that, below that was largely white and Indian. But you know, I told Nene this, right? I remember this. I was very impressed. I was very impressed. Young people like you and us, that were there. I was very impressed. In fact, the majority of the people we met were young African people, highly articulate, very clear. The Mama says, yeah, Eunice, one day I can quote this. Many of them were poached from us, right? And then this is a classic example. Then when I met Praveen one day, I said, Praveen, you know what impresses me? In the DOC as well, you know, I came from the local government sector. We are municipal managers, hey, Pinky, you know, right? Let's not say anything more. Then I go into DOC for a brief while. I also thought it's dominated by whites and Indians. How wrong I was, man. Hey, they were these young African people, you know? I mean, 25, 26, I just imagine what they'd be like when they're 40. Look at Onati. He's probably 18 years old, right? Imagine when he's 60. No, really, it's inspiring, Momo. No, I know.
He's 21 tomorrow.
He's 21 tomorrow, okay. Okay. All right, he's exaggerating his age because he wants to be taken seriously. I'm telling you, you know, you can say what you like about Sandy. Okay, I speak English, right? As my first language, not Sesotho, right? So I'll give it slightly more subtle and polished words. But what she is saying, the thrust of what she is saying, and I like the way she says it because she's speaking from the heart.
Yeah.
And she's not trying to manage, you know, from the chair. I actually agree with everything she's saying. And it's pretty Basa. Basa, are you listening? Where are you? I don't see your... Where's Patel? But you are here, right? Basa was listened to because I really think, you know what, it's going to be beyond our control. Momo, you know all these things. You've studied post-revolutionary situations, right? And this thing is looming. Look at the students right now.
Yeah.
A Communist Party General Secretary is unable to have credibility around this issue, right? And you know what our traditional theory is, the working class and the intelligentsia and the youth alliance, right? That's what in the developing world we have. So what I'm saying is, I don't think one should be dismissive. I'm appealing to your colleagues in particular to what Thandi is saying. The DA can disagree and all, it's fine. I'm telling you what Thandi is saying is the view of the vast majority of the ANC, how you do these things, and milestones and time frames. Yeah, we have to do it, Mama, and Treasury, really, for all the good work you do, I don't think it's sufficiently sensitive to this. You in particular are meant to be, because you are a comrade of considerable experience. These are younger people who don't have your considerable background. I mean, Momo, you're a great guy, but if you don't provide leadership here on these issues, I'm telling you, we are lost. Who better person than you? Well, are you among the better people who could play this role? So, I want to endorse what Thandi says. I hope industry is listening. I think you've gone further than I suspected. So in that sense, Momo, you have surprised me. I thought you would wriggle and fight, but you have done something. But it's nowhere near what we need. But can you help us with which of the other bills that are coming we can insert more of a transformation agenda? Not a populist one. Yeah.
I don't think if you start with the financial sector charter, because frankly it's a platform that's not been utilized enough. Okay, and I think, look, some of that, there are strong structural factors. That's what Cathy was referring to as well. Okay, I mean, the reality with our banks, just to make a point, we've got 2.5 banks that are on sale, and nobody wants to buy them. And of course, the majority owned is actually foreign capital. Okay, but banking itself, I think, can actually we must just take banking out for a while and just talk generally. I think it's easier with the others. Banking, you need to deal with specifics, and it would be good one day if you get the governor and Nati and so on, because I think he has, you know, they do give this a lot of thought, but I think the reality is that not many people want to come in and own a bank. If they have money, they prefer to go elsewhere. And if you look at all the, you know, post-2008 provisions, it's actually, banking is no longer as profitable as it was before 2008. So there are those sorts of challenges that we need to just take into account as well.
But the point is, you don't have a black-owned bank, a significant black. She's right. I mean, when are we going to... You see, it's not that we don't have it, I think, is the point she's making. There's no sign that we're going to have it. And she's talking of 30 years, so she's not being...
We don't have it yet.
Yeah, but there's no... Yeah, and there's no sign. Small ones, yeah. Now, what I think you're saying, Thandi, also, it's not just that we don't have it. It's that there's no sign we'll have it in the foreseeable future. And it's for government and the South African Reserve Bank and everybody to encourage that. That's what we're saying. And in our report, and in what you're saying is basically your speech to the House on this debate. There's your speech. You record it, that's what you're going to say. You know, you can add to it. So, Unati, she put some questions to you. And I know Reserve Banks claim they're independent, but the question is there something you can do to encourage black, meaning basically African ownership of banks in time to come? Aren't you worried about it, Unati? Of course
you are, but I mean, if you're occupying the Reserve Bank now, not that you would say you can do much, but are these issues that you think they reflect about these banks are more honest?
I think certainly in terms of thinking about it, Chair, we, as Mom was saying, we actually spend a lot of time having internal discussions around it because it's difficult to be an institution with such a responsibility of a public policy mandate to not be seized with some of these questions. But I do want to say it's about locating the responsibility of institutions and the instruments that they have to achieve specific objectives. So in the Prudential case, we are sort of custodians of the regulatory framework. So we are limited by what the regulatory framework can actually do. We can be enabling, but more than that, what do you do as a prudential regulator? There's a framework that says, in the protection of depositors, you have to have the following prudential requirements. You don't do this because you don't want people to own banks. You do this because banks, given their special role in the economy, have to be safe. They have to be prudentially sound. And this is for the benefit of the ordinary mother from Danzane, Eshowe, Budeli Village, etc., who places their money in this institution, that they must actually go to sleep peacefully at night, that the following day their money will be there. So this is not for the institution that you regulate. It is for the protection of depositors. So I think that many times that gets lost, that, you know, we're just being hard for the sake of being hard. You have to ensure prudential soundness of these institutions. And then the second one relates to, you know, the market structure issues. But those must be looked at within the context of how banking has evolved in South Africa. Between 1998 and 2002, because of the Asian crisis and the failure of Sambo and other smaller banks, we lost 22 banks in a space of 4 years. Not because we did anything wrong, right? So what does that do? It increases concentration because you force consolidation as a response to a crisis. So that is not a policy decision or a regulatory decision that says we want fewer banks, we don't want greater competition, but it says in order to continue to have stability in the sector, this is the decision that you must take. So I think there's a lot of different objectives, policy objectives that one has to consider. It's not a we will not license additional banks. I mean, the slide just showed there that this, by the end of this year, it's possible that we might have licensed 3 first-tier banks. The Post Bank was given a Section 12 license this year. They have 12 months to go through a few requirements, and if they meet those, they will actually have a first-tier banking license. And given their infrastructure and their access, I mean, if the kind of business model that they pursue is a successful one, that would be a very important gain or achievement for financial inclusion and access. And we also need to be considering banks of the future. Banks of the future are not going to be what you have currently. They're going to come from disruptive players, fintech, different types of products and value-added products and services that people will be able to give in the space and will therefore not be regulated in the same way they can't be. So all of these discussions have to be considered within that context, the changing landscape, the evolution of the banking sector, and the respective roles of different players and regulators. And of course, the important role of industry as well, but also the important role of the competition authorities, because we want to have more banks, yes, but what we want even more is competition. And doesn't happen automatically because you issue more licenses, that people will actually be successful. Unfortunately, in our country, we don't really have many sterling examples of successful small, medium-sized banks. Because by its very nature, when you are a larger institution, you are much more able to diversify. So if something happens in another sector, you adjust and, you know, make your money in another sector. But if you're a small niche bank, monoline, if something happens in the sector that you're exposed to, then you are gone. So there are all those challenges. You can get a banking license, and you can even be black-owned. But there are other things that must be at play to make sure that you succeed as an owner of a bank. It's not a simple, the sub must give the license.